May proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Bev Davis, and I represent Paul D'Amico, the appellant in this matter. I believe this is a case of first impression involving the unreasonable refusal statute, which is applied when someone is legally arrested for driving under the influence in the Commonwealth. Section 18.2-268.3, the refusal statute, says that it shall be unlawful for any person arrested for violation of 18.2-266 and other such code sections or similar ordinances to unreasonably refuse to have samples of his blood or breath taken once arrested. This is a unique case in that the arresting officer of the appellant in Montgomery County was not the breath test operator who actually was doing the procedures of the breath test. And as the facts of this case unfolded, the arresting officer who took the appellant to the breath test room after arrest for DUI in violation of 18.2266, the breath test operator was the only one in the room present during those procedures while the arresting officer went out of the room to use the bathroom. That's clear and unequivocal in the facts of this case and testified to by the breath test operator that the arresting officer was not present for any of those procedures associated with the taking of the breath test. The statute calls for when someone refuses, and of course the statute 18.2268.3 is of course was not a statute of common law. So we would argue that strict construction applies with its elements. It does outline the elements of what an unreasonable refusal would be. And of course then it outlines what the arresting officer is mandated to do in order to have a prima facie case presented in front of the magistrate in order to issue the summons or warrant. The arresting officer under 18.2268.3c clearly states, and it's clear and unambiguous, the arresting officer shall, under oath, he has to swear to this before the magistrate, execute the form and certify that the defendant has refused to permit the blood or breath or any sort of situation with regard to his blood or breath. He has to refuse that in the presence of the arresting officer. The arresting officer has to then read him a form, and that form is mandated by the Office of the Executive Secretary of the Supreme Court. And on that form, it talks about that the arresting officer must swear that the accused in front of him has refused, that he has read this lengthy form to him, and then after having had that form read to him, refused again to have a sample of his blood or breath taken. And with regards to the trial of this case, there has been some mention that perhaps we, as the trial counsel, did not preserve the objection. We did object to the admissibility of the declaration and acknowledgement of refusal form. It's in transcript of the Joint Appendix, page 32. There was, of course, an I object. And there was language that was used that says, quote, the arresting officer has to do all this, not the breath test operator, referring to the statute itself. So, and then there was argument made on that objection. How can the arresting officer swear that the breath test operator did this? The statute is written for the arresting officer to have to be the affiant. The statute is written for such that this creates an offense. Although at first it is a civil offense, it first language indicates that it shall be unlawful. So it creates an offense for someone to unreasonably refuse. And as such, the arresting officer, by the statute itself, the General Assembly put this language in there for a very good reason. And that's because the arresting officer has to go in front of the magistrate, raise his right hand, and he has to swear that he read this declaration and not a refusal form.
But counsel, if you look at the later statute, I guess it's point 11, it says that failure to comply with any of these steps, of course, goes to the weight of the evidence. So imagine a situation where you didn't have a form at all. I mean, do you think you can be convicted of this crime without a form at all, for example?
Well, the statute that you refer to is commonly referred to as a substantial compliance statute.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's what the Commonwealth argued. But under 18.2268.3c, it says that the arresting officer shall, under oath before the magistrate, execute the form. And so it's clearly referring to the form that is provided by the Office of the Executive Secretary of the Supreme Court. And without the magistrate having that executed form in front of them, I'd answer your question that, yes, they have to have that form. And
so you could never have a conviction. You could never prove unreasonable refusal without presenting that form, which means that it's really, I mean, you look at this as an element of the crime, right?
I mean, you're saying and I look at
a valid form is a requirement.
I do look at it as an element of the crime because the statute creates it as an element. Because there is, as I indicated before, it under 18.2268.3b, it talks about the form that the arresting officer shall advise the person by. And then
it goes on, at the end of that section, it says this is what constitutes probable cause for the magistrate to issue the warrant.
Okay. And then
that's different than it being an element of the crime, isn't it?
Okay. But then the very next part C talks about...
No, that is C. That's
yes.
The last sentence of C that I just read to you. Such sworn certification shall constitute probable cause for the magistrate to issue a warrant.
For summons, charging the person with unreasonable
refusal. Right.
Yes. And but without that form, I guess you're saying that the arresting officer himself could swear that he did these things.
Right. I'm asking it as a hypothetical. Could he do that?
Under the reading of it, I don't think it's intended to be that way. I don't think the legislature intended that. But I could see where I think this court could so rule in that the form is not needed. I think it's an element. But with that statement, as you pointed out, I do believe that that's the situation. However, the form itself has to be sworn to. He has to execute the form. And what is...
Has he answered your question? Mm-hmm. Counsel, picking up on what Justice McClanahan just asked about this providing probable cause to the magistrate to issue the warrant, did you file a motion prior to trial to suppress the warrant?
No. If it becomes a matter of proof at trial,
if you're challenging the sufficiency of the probable cause to issue the warrant, I believe Rule 3:389 indicates that you have to file a motion 7 days before trial to attack that.
I understand where you're going with that, but with regards to what happened at the proof at trial did not lead to the elements of the statute being fulfilled.
Well, look at the elements of the statute. As I read the statute, there are three elements: that the accused refused to give a blood or breath sample, that the accused was advised of the consequences of the refusal, and that the accused again refused to give a breath or blood sample. Are those the elements of the crime as you understand it?
Yes.
And so if the other officer testified to each of those three elements, let's assume the form is defective and doesn't and should not have come in. If the other officer testified to each of those three elements, why wouldn't the crime still have been proved?
That's why, and I'm glad you asked that question, that's why this is a fatal variance, because when you have on the face of the warrant itself that you've been given a sheet of paper, a warrant or summons, it says that you violated 18.2-268.3. The complainant's sworn testimony of the arresting officer, Deputy Schrader, you then get to court And you're relying on the fact that that person is going to be there to be the one who provides the evidence. They don't have to talk to us before trial. You don't necessarily have to know that this is going to be an issue. That's why you have to be on your toes. And when something like this happens, it's the fatal variance comes into play, is because the arresting officer is not the one who's sworn to do it by statute, is the one who did it at this trial. It was the breath test operator. And nobody at all argues that it was other than that. So with regards to this very fact pattern, the arresting officer by statute who has to swear that these things were done, where it was not done, and the face of the warrant itself for us to attack it pre-trial, we would have to assume that that's not going to be the case. And with that not being the case, then we're left with having to, at trial, make a motion to strike, which we did, which would attack the sufficiency of the evidence after the Commonwealth rested. And with regards to whether or not there was a sufficient motion to strike, in the reply brief, there was some indication that the document itself is hearsay. And everybody knows that it's hearsay. But it becomes inadmissible and unreliable hearsay. And we argued points of lack of personal knowledge on behalf of the person who has to create that document in order for it to also be inadmissible. The case
of this... Can I stop you just for a second? Because I think Justice Powell's question was, why couldn't the crime be proved by having the person who was doing the breathalyzer there to testify that the defendant refused to take the breathalyzer test? Why wouldn't your answer be, they weren't there, that's why I win?
That's correct.
No, the officer who actually administered the breathalyzer test and told him you have to take the test and he refused was at trial and did testify to those very things, was he not?
He was at trial, but the person who has to swear to it in order for it to be properly...
The person who has to swear to the form, and the form gets you a prima facie case, so he doesn't necessarily have to get on the stand and say, I told him this, he refused, I told him this, he didn't sign it. You put the form in it. But if there is someone else in the room, and in this case I believe there was, who actually administered the test, gentleman refused to take it, he read him the form, which is what he testified on the stand, I told him he has to take it, he wouldn't take it, that person was in the room and testified, was in the courtroom and testified. Why isn't that sufficient?
Because the arresting officer, who had no knowledge of that, and on transcript of 34, we objected. And we said...
I understand the arresting officer wasn't in the room, signed the form in front of the magistrate. I don't disagree with you on those facts. But there was a plan B, if you will. The person who was in the room, who attempted to administer the test, did testify to all of that.
That's where the fatal variance would come in, because the warrant itself is defective with regard that the arresting officer did not have personal
knowledge. But you didn't
knowledge.
Challenge the warrant under 389. You didn't challenge it. You have to do it 7 days before trial. So where does that get you? Where does that leave you?
We moved to strike the case on the grounds that they didn't substantially comply with the clear and unambiguous elements there in the statute, 18.2268.3. I'd like to reserve my next 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Okay. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Kiernan on behalf of the Commonwealth. This Court should affirm the defendant's conviction for failing to take a breathalyzer test in this case for three reasons. First, with or without the certificate of refusal, the Commonwealth's evidence in this case was sufficient to prove all of the elements of the unreasonable refusal offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Second, substantial compliance with the code section at issue in this case is sufficient. Therefore, it does not matter which police officer read the defendant his pre-existing obligation to take a breathalyzer. And finally, even if strict compliance was sufficient, the refusal form was properly admitted into evidence in this case. As the Court noted, the substantive elements of the unlawful refusal offense, as evidenced by the plain language of the code section itself,
the Virginia model jury instructions, and this court's case, Williams versus Commonwealth, are three. First, that the defendant operated a vehicle and was arrested for a DUI. Second, that he refused to take a breathalyzer test to determine the alcoholic content of his blood. And third, that that refusal was unreasonable. All three of those elements were met in this case, and the defendant is not contesting that he was arrested for a DUI while driving on Route 460 in Montgomery County, that he subsequently refused to take a breathalyzer test three times despite being informed of his obligation to do so by Officer Nelson, using the statutorily prescribed form and also in layman's terms. And third, that his refusal to take this breathalyzer test was unreasonable. The defendant gave a reason for refusing, and it was that he wanted to speak to a lawyer. This court has held in Bailey versus Commonwealth and Coleman versus Commonwealth that that's not a reasonable ground for a refusal. Commonwealth has proved all these elements beyond a reasonable doubt, and those elements aren't being contested here today. The issue before this court, rather, is despite having proven every substantive element of this offense beyond a reasonable doubt, this conviction should be overturned because a police officer, other than the arresting officer, informed the defendant of his obligation to take a breathalyzer test. The answer to this question must be no. The code section at issue in this case, 18.2268.3, is only required to be substantially complied with. And as Justice McClanahan pointed out, the General Assembly is clear on this issue. There's a whole separate code section which says the steps set forth in 18.2268.2-9 relating to the taking of a breath sample. This code section does relate to the taking of a breath sample. It is, in fact, the first step in taking of a breath sample, telling the person they have to take it and asking that they do take it. It says that these code sections are procedural and not substantive, and I'm quoting, substantial compliance shall be sufficient. Failure to comply with any steps or portions thereof shall not itself be grounds for finding the defendant not guilty, but shall go the weight of the evidence to be considered with all the evidence in this case. Substantial compliance is the appropriate standard in this case, and the Commonwealth did substantially comply with the procedural requirements of this code section. Officer Nelson, in this case, using the statutorily prescribed form, did inform the defendant of his obligation to take a breath test. Thereafter, the defendant refused. Substantial compliance has been met, and as we've argued, all of the substantive elements of the offense have also been proven by the Commonwealth in this case. There is no basis for reversing this opinion, or rather the judgment of the Circuit Court of Montgomery County. Furthermore, this court has interpreted 18.2268.3 and the use of the word shall in that code section as directory and not mandatory. In Rafferty versus Commonwealth and also in Eames versus Rocky Mount, the word shall in this code section referring to other actions of the magistrate or whether the word court means a jury can't use it, they've all been held to be subject to substantial compliance. And the specific language pointed to by the defendant in this case is no different.
Counsel, if you didn't have the testimony here of the breathalyzer operator, and all you had was the form that the arresting officer admittedly was not in the room at the time when the advice was given, the form was read to him, would your position be the same, that there was evidence sufficient to sustain the conviction?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, is your question whether in any case there needs to be evidence from someone that the form was read, or just in this case whether Officer Schrader's...
If you just took this case and deleted the testimony of the person who administered the breath test, would your position be the same, that there was sufficient evidence nevertheless to sustain this conviction?
Yes, Your Honor, because the refusal form in this case was properly admitted into evidence.
Why was it properly admitted?
Because all of the objections raised by the defendant were properly overruled by the trial court, and the defendant did not raise a hearsay objection to the trial court in this case. The defendant's three objections he asserts on brief, that the form doesn't comply with the code section, the oath was falsely sworn, and of course the third, that the form violates evidence law. The first is an issue of sufficiency, not an issue of admissibility, so that wouldn't have been a ground for keeping the form out. The second, that the form's oath is falsely sworn, that's just not well-founded on the record of this case. There's no evidence that Schrader falsely swore out this affidavit. Testimony at trial was that he didn't recall, not that he affirmatively didn't do it. his lack of recollection does not render the certificate on the form, which was sworn over a year earlier, falsely sworn. Because there's no evidence the form was falsely sworn, that's not a basis for precluding its admission. And finally, no hearsay objection was raised to the trial court.
If there was, if a hearsay objection had been properly raised, would that have been a valid objection?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because the form in this case, the black letter form, is official publication of the Commonwealth, and it's subject to judicial notice. All of the handwritten portions...
Well, but it's the information that matters in the form, not the form itself.
Well, the court knows, the court can take notice of what the contents of that form is, and Schrader also said, yes, this is the form. This is the form I presented to the magistrate. It bears my signature. He knows what the form is, and he signed it, and he's testified to all of the handwritten additions to that form. So because the form comes in itself, and the handwritten additions have had a proper foundation laid for them, any issue
was
about...
Was there a proper foundation? I'm sorry. Had she finished answering your question?
No, go ahead.
Was there a proper foundation laid for them? I thought he did make a foundation objection.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe a foundation objection was made. The defendant's objection went to whether or not, under the code section, for compliance with the code section, the arresting officer or another officer had to swear on this document. He wasn't making a hearsay objection or a foundation objection, and his statement that everyone knows it's hearsay, the trial court didn't know it was hearsay. The trial court was not aware that that was the basis for his objection. The trial court clearly said that he was being called upon to decide a novel statutory interpretation. He said it was an issue he wasn't familiar with. And hearsay or foundation are simply not objections the trial court would have been so unfamiliar with that he needed to take the matter under advisement. Whether or not the defendant believed he was raising a hearsay objection, you know, what this court needs to look at is whether the trial court was aware of that objection, whether the trial court had the opportunity to rule on it, and it's unfair for this court to put a different twist on the evidence at trial, as this court held under Shiplett and under its 525 jurisprudence. An objection on the same issue, but not the specific one before the court, is not going to be sufficient to preserve it, and the objection was not preserved in this
case. Let's go back to the form. So is it your position that because the arresting officer acknowledged his signature on the form as being his signature, that that's sufficient for admission even when the officer cannot say, yes, I did what the form says I did? He just said it. He didn't say he didn't do it. He just said, I don't remember. All I know is that's my signature. That makes it admissible because he acknowledges his signature alone?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that his lack of recollection goes to the weight of that evidence, to its credibility, not to its admissibility. He recognizes this is the form, this is my form, this is the form I submitted to the magistrate, and yes, there's my signature. That's sufficient foundation for this form to come in. The weight that the trial court places on that evidence, however, may be correctly impacted by his statement that he doesn't recall with specificity anything further. It doesn't impact the admissibility of that document, but, again, rather the credibility of it and the weight the trial court can place on that evidence.
What's the significance of the fact that I believe he did admit that he wasn't even in the room when there were attempts to administer the test?
He was not in the room, Your Honor, when the breath test operator attempted to administer the test. However, that statement doesn't preclude Deputy Schrader from having advised the defendant of his obligation to take this test at a separate time. He did swear in front of the magistrate, and the magistrate acknowledged that he had read this form to the defendant under oath a year prior. There's ample time for the Deputy Schrader to have done so in this case. Just because he wasn't present when another officer did it does not mean that he never did or he affirmatively did not. The Commonwealth's belt and suspenders approach in this case, having multiple officers advise the defendant of his obligation to take a breathalyzer, shouldn't be penalized. And again, there's no evidence that form was falsely sworn. And in any event, there was evidence from Officer Nelson that everything was read to the defendant as it should have been, and all of the substantive elements of this code section were complied with. And unless the court has further questions, I rest on the remainder of my brief.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just leave a couple minutes left. I'll be brief. With regard to the foundational question as to whether or not that was raised, again, I would reiterate the point that when they first tried to introduce the declaration acknowledgement of refusal form, we immediately objected and said we object to the admissibility of the form.
What page are you on, counsel?
Transcript 32.
Thank you.
The arresting officer has to do all of this, not the breath test operator. Or if you join Appendix 32, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. How can the arresting officer swear that the breath test operator did it? The statute is written for the arresting officer to have to be the authority. Transcripts, joint appendix, page 35. We also respectfully move to strike, and then we renewed all of our motions. With regards to the foundational question, perhaps, and when you get to transcript of page 34, the joint appendix, they then called the arresting officer back to the stand. They knew they had a problem, and they tried to call the arresting officer back to the stand to try to bolster his personal knowledge, and they tried to do so by way of hearsay. And we objected, and we said, I believe in the joint appendix 34, we said, objection, I object, and then we used the language, I believe, they offer for the truth of the matter asserted. I did not say, objection, hearsay, they offer for the truth of the matter asserted. I said, objection, they offer for the truth of the matter asserted. And the Commonwealth Attorney at that point just went on because he knew that he was requesting and inquiring about inadmissible evidence with regard to hearsay.
Counsel, what was your best evidence that your client was prejudiced by this defect?
Well, with regards to this offense, if this conviction stands, and I'm not advocating for him to ever get another one, but he then would stand in line to have a crime be committed in addition to the one that he was charged with. He's been prejudiced because, one, the clear and unambiguous language of the 18.268.3 statute has been violated and has been construed against him, and his liberty has been taken because he won't be able to drive for 12 months.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Call the next case, please.